Here is Janet Dallet, November 23rd, 1991. Encounter with the Dark Gods. Tape number 1 of 3.
October 23, 1991. Janet Dallet, Encounter with the Dark Gods. Speaking about her book, the recent one, Saturday's Child.
We're beginning into what I consider to be extraordinarily difficult material today, and with a small group, I hope we can really go deep into it. The book of Proverbs says, where there is no vision, the people perish. That's, I suppose, the equivalent of what Jung says at the end of the filmed BBC interview, in which he says, man cannot endure a meaningless life. My compulsion to write books comes from my need for a vision, my need to find meaning. When I write, what I'm trying to do is to find or create the meaning of my life by making visible the patterns behind the things that happen to me, the things that if I have my nose down in them, or when I have my nose down in them, just seem like the ordinary events of life. But when I can stand back and get a larger view and begin to see some of the patterns that are woven, become quite extraordinary. When I put this material that is mine out into the world, I hope also to help others in the search for meaning in their own lives, not to set my life up as an example, but rather to stimulate that process in other people. And that's why today what I hope we can do is talk together about what my book Saturday's Child has brought up in you in terms of the meaning of events in your life. I want to talk about your questions, your comments, your amplifications. What has this book stirred up in you? Before we begin doing that, to sort of set the stage of, and give a really cosmic view of some of these things, I want to read you a few of Jung's very large and non-personal observations. These are observations that, in fact, lie behind the very personal content of my own book. See if you can understand how these things, which constitute the unconscious background of life in the world today, affect you in your daily life. What is your role in a time when the psyche is giving birth to a new century and a new age? What's your part in that? Can you find your vision in this material? This is my challenge to you today. In Memories, Dreams, Reflection, Jung wrote this. The myth of the necessary incarnation of God can be understood as man's creative confrontation with the opposites and their synthesis in the self. And by the self, he means the wholeness of his personality. That is the goal which fits man meaningfully into the scheme of creation and at the same time confers meaning upon it. That's one of Jung's statements about the meaning for him of this time. Here's another one which I've made a note on. It says creed for the new eon. This is from Answer to Job. He says, I don't know what Job is supposed to have seen, but it seems possible that he unconsciously anticipated the historical future namely the evolution of the God image. God had to become man. Man's suffering does not derive from his sins, but from the maker of his imperfections, the paradoxical God. Got that? Man's suffering does not derive from his sins, but from the maker of his imperfections, the paradoxical God. Pretty mind-blowing statement. The righteous man is the instrument into which God enters in order to attain self-reflection and thus consciousness and rebirth as a divine child trusted to the care of adult man. Now, I have a long letter that Jung wrote to a woman named Elena Tochnik in 1956, I think, that has some of these ideas in very, very explicit form, very explicit description of his vision of the evolution of the God image and the human relations ego to it. It's very difficult material. I think what I'll do is leave you right at the moment with these little bits that I've thrown out, and perhaps we can begin talking about Saturday's child in that context, and see if it feels right later today to tackle this this long and difficult letter. I'm also open, incidentally, to if people have leftovers from last night. So, if you have leftover unanswered questions, we can also get into those.
Just that word, the evolution of the God image. It suddenly does put it in a human perspective. And when I consider the ways I've been feeling most recently about the struggle of between the opposites, so being furious that I have to, that I have the affects that I have, and, you know, and the emotions and the splitting apart feelings, and it feels like I'm being played with in some divine realm that all I have, you know, my own question is just to keep asking questions. And it's good to have someone who you can ask the questions to. And it's good to have you here to have, because you come from that position of really hearing the question solved, you know, meeting the answer. But that the evolution of the God image is just that statement itself does a lot for me. That his consciousness for the consciousness of the mystery is always being exploded inside of us.
Yeah, thanks. I think you've got it. I think you've got hold of what this is about.
And there's not very many places where it can be held, you know, and grave.
Yeah.
Therefore the scriptures.
Yeah, that's right. You want to talk a little more
about what
you mean by that? I know what you mean by that, but I'm not.
What I mean by that. I have implosions of seeing the big picture frequently. My dream, a recent event was, I was at a key, and I just was stayed away from the ordinary realm of my name, and I was laying on the back of a boat, and as I was writing about an event that happened the night before, which brought me to tremendous heaving tears for some completely unknown reason, I just had that so much affect. I was crying and sobbing from a sorrow that I had never felt so deep before in my life. And I was writing, I had to stop it because the person I was with was freaked out. I said, okay, so now I need to come back out of it to take care of this person that I'm with because they don't understand. And so I was trying to get back to what it was if I had continued in my writing. If I had continued without interruption, where would I have gone to? What would have been spoken to me? And at that moment, above me, Everglade kite. Now, I had seen an Everglade kite every day since I had been there. But I'd seen one for several times a day. I'd see a couple. In came a swirling of 40 or 50 Everglade kite. And they were flying on the airframe that I received it, and they moved a lot. And it was one, and they were just circling, swirling, not flapping their wings, but just circling, swirling. And that reminded me of a dream I had, exactly like a dream I had. So I remembered it was just before I left that I had that dream, when Arnie Zaslow, the math lecture, came about. So I went back to that dream, and I saw that in the dream, a woman had given me a book, and she had made it, and it had these swirling pictures of black birds at the time. I thought were swirls because they were black, and here you are in the Northwest, but I wasn't sure. Now I realize that they were just black birds. They were these types. And in the dream, it went on to say how desire was set in motion, and desire thought itself in its motion to watch itself delight and experience joy. And I then saw that the person I was with, because at the end of the dream there was I closed the book, and I realized that desire is set in motion by objects or a lover, and that it's not the object or the lover that is desired, but the desire for movement, the desire to that energy. I closed the book and I looked up, and in my dream I saw a face of a man who had birds across his face, the image of the bird. And that image, I realized, was the man that I was with, and who I had to come back out of this experience just to calm down. But after I had that experience, I realized that I had something really happen that reminded me of a dream that filled me with the understanding of where desire comes from, and yet the separation, the aspects of okay, now what do I do with this energy? What do I do with this knowledge? And I don't know what else to say.
That's the schizoid thing, isn't it? That's an expression of the fact that we don't have religious containers. We don't have it's like you had a numinous experience, and a very meaningful one. Yeah.
I mean, every moment, yeah. The moment was powerfully magical, and I felt. But the trick was, I felt the power both in myself. I was the sky. I was the bird. I was the emotion. I was everything. I was this man. I was where I was. I was the water. I was everything all at the same time. And it made so much sense. And then to fall from that. Okay, so what?
Now what do I do? Yeah, now what do I do with this? That's a marvelous statement of what we are confronted with in this time. It is as if you experienced an inflowing of the God. And your emotion was like a piece of the unconscious God image, the unconscious self. And then if that is not to then ultimately have negative effects, but become an integrated and positive experience, what do you do with it? I don't have an answer for that. That's a very powerful statement of what we are confronted with in this time. Yeah, that's an amazing experience. It has.
It makes me really be thankful that I follow my dreams, as much as I do.
Yeah, and that for you and...
That's the first that really has aspect, lived out in this life, reality.
Yeah.
If someone was next to me, they could have changed them. So it does bring me back to realizing what is being said in this dream, how much is being said through my unconscious, how much of it is necessary for me to be in the world around me. And how much other people don't say.
That's right. That's right. And it's important to be aware how presumptuous it is when one makes it. It's like, oh, how can I say that?
Something that would satisfy myself,
yeah.
And be able to be communicated.
Or something that would satisfy it.
Yeah.
In response to that, I'm going to read one of the many mind-blowing statements in this letter that I mentioned. Jung says, "We have become participants of the divine life, and we have to assume a new responsibility vis-a-vis the continuation of the divine self-realization, which expresses itself in the task of our individuation. This means practically that we become adult, responsible for our existence, knowing that we do not only depend on God, but that God also depends on man. Man's relation to God probably has to undergo a certain important change. Instead of the propitiating praise to an unpredictable king or the child's prayer to a loving father, the responsible living and fulfilling of the divine will in us will be our form of worship and commerce with God. And for the artist, that responsible living of the divine will is exactly what you suggest. Or for the creative person.
So in somewhere in here, in one of these 300 things I remember, there's a statement about the importance of when you have that kind of experience of that sort of infusion and that now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
My reading of what you said, and I might be able to find it in a while, suggested that what's important is to stay with that and not take, by your discretion, inhibitors, not take any action initially, but simply stay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it will become, it will work itself out in some kind of way that will take care of that in a way that's congruent or that works.
Yeah, simple, literal acting out very often leads to evil, what we would call evil. The simple unconscious just being driven to act it out. If you consider, for instance, in here my vision of the man who goes into the desert and throws himself back and something comes down, a knife comes down from above and kills him. That's the kind of material that I'm sure lies beyond a lot of demonic cult activity. It's the same vision, but what's done with it, you know, it makes a great deal of difference.
Uh-huh. And what I get from that is that one of the tasks I'm working on is to sort of make my own container, not in isolation, but in addition,
mm-hmm.
and just allow that to be in that place, not running from it nor embracing it, but just letting it be.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
That other things happen and it gets taken care of. There's some sort of way of collecting it out there.
Yeah.
That's
at least part of it. I would say that another part of it is the sometimes there is the confrontation of it. I mean, sometimes whatever this content is seems immoral to the ego or shocking or terrible, and then the ego confronts it and argues with it, and at other times it seems incomprehensible, and then one questions. And the being with it can be many, many years.
Okay,
yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. It's like you're grabbed by the back of the neck and it's standing there shaking you for years. And why, you know, what is this?
Question for everybody here. I was wondering if anyone else here feels, I don't know why I have this idea, but it maybe has something to do with the evolution of the God in its dynamic necessity, is that I've always felt that it is necessary to embody the self, for Kelly to embody the self.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the goal. Now, sometimes when I think of that, I think I'm out of my mind, that I, you know, who do I think I want to be? You know, how does that affect me? How does that affect the people around me? And is that narcissistic? Is it annihilation of my ego? Is it, you know, is it God trying to fit into the ego? Or...
It's really.
Is anybody else?
Yeah.
I don't know where I came up with this idea. I don't know.
that I went from various naturopathic to homeopathic to try to release the emotion of it and find me. But yet it's still there. And what was the gift? I needed to be embodied to feel all of this.
Somewhere Jung says God wants to become man, but not quite. And that's the trick. That's the trick of the question you're struggling with. As long as you have doubts and questions, you're living in the not quite. And then you're adequately grounded to be working with this process. As soon as you forget the not quite, then you might be in trouble with it. Now, one reason for this is in its early unconscious manifestations, the self is really pretty awful. Or it's this paradoxical thing. It can be pretty awful. And when you talk about being taken over by overwhelming emotions, that's that divine stuff in us in its untransformed state. And it can, as you know from Saturday Child, it can be rage as well as any other kind of emotion, and it can have terrible consequences if one is unable to carry and contain it and keep a foot in the not quite. The not quite is what the alchemists called the axiom of Maria, and it's this ambiguity as to whether it's an ambiguity between the numbers 3 and the numbers 4. It's like 4 is completeness and 3 is on the way to completeness. And it's as if the psyche in its imagery insists that that we never get to 4. Completeness never happens except perhaps in death. It's only somewhere between the 3 and the 4.
I feel in my sadness that it is so wonderful and awesome, and yet it's so pathetic. Because I mean, my sister and my Kelly just walked around in this sadness, and it's like, I don't have anything to give anybody. What am I here for if I don't have anything to give anybody? I realized that I was experiencing in my own life
similar kinds of things that my mother had experienced in her relationship to my father, and that I was kind of succeeding in that. And it was the first time that I had ever really empathized with my mother's grief. And instead of feeling good, which is what I felt as a child, I felt, I don't know, beauty is the right word, but it was not her, it was something else. And it was, for the first time, I gained relief, and I felt a peacefulness that I never ever dreamed I would have, and feeling sad and bound crying. I never realized that there could be something on the other side that it isn't her.
So a piece of the chaotic stuff that we tend to think of as negative was then transformed through your working with it in that way, relating to it.
But it's opened up a new place to your job, like the learning time, and that's just
Yeah, that's a piece.
And the sense that keeps coming back to me is that we must embody these things. And there must be a need for God to have these things occur on us. Otherwise, why would we be so tolerant? So, at the drop of our heart, the realization of revelation comes to us.
Yeah, it's as if something has reached out and touched many people in this way. Jung's view of it, as he talks about it in answer to Job, is that the incarnation in Christ was the first incarnation, and that that the mythic imagery of it then conveys that Christ was the example which then must be lived, not in a literal way, not in a literal imitating of Christ, but through the kind of things that you people are talking about, the incarnation in all of us. Now, I want to make clear, in case it isn't clear, that I'm talking depth psychology. I'm talking about the archetypal level of the psyche. I'm not talking theology, even though it sounds theology. We have to keep the perspective of observing what goes on in the psyche, what is going on in people's psyches in the depths. And the kinds of things that you people are talking about are pieces of data in that process.
I believe it was the woman who was being kidnapped, that had been in the home, and how you didn't feel the foreboding or fear that your partner felt. And I thought that was rather interesting, because I've had that occur before where I'm like in a dream or something that's kind of horrific to me. Something that would make the head stand on it. And yet, something like this event might occur around it now, but there's still a feeling of that. And after I read this prayer, I thought about it. I tried to think of certain things before that was true, and it was quite feasible. At least in different various meanings of the disease. Quite frankly, I don't know what to do with it. To think about that, like you're going along feeling like a lost dog, when there is horrific energy, and you might even be able to feel it. What I tend to do is just not give it any grief in the real world, or do the best I can with that. Because it feels like, there is probably some danger.
Yeah, it could be extraordinarily dangerous.
And so, just holding on to that kind of letting it sit deep through if you can. If you can,
right? Are you talking about images from your dreams?
It might be very horrific, and I'm thinking of the events occurring, but then feeling this sort of It's like an inflated calm.
Mm-hmm. It's cut off from the sort of human fear response that is appropriate to the situation.
What causes that?
The human fear response?
The cutting off.
Well, that's a good question. I've struggled with that a lot, to understand, for instance, the material that I wrote about that you're talking about, where I simply just was sort of going along la-di-da in this really potentially extremely dangerous situation, and feeling something like the peace of God that passeth all understanding, and getting pulled. I'm working around to your question. In that situation, I think what happened was that an archetype was constellated that involved the aggressor or abuser and the victim, and that archetype, for various reasons in my personal background, has always been a very potent one for me. It's like when that archetype is activated in the environment, then if I fall unconsciously into it, which in the past I did over and over again, then I would feel that enormous sense of peace. It's as if this material that constituted a very basic piece of my life and came up repeatedly, it was as if that was God for me, and I experienced it in a very peaceful way. However, if I had not become conscious of it and begun to try to live it in a different way, in a more conscious way, other than being drawn in peacefully into really enormously dangerous situations, I think probably that it would have killed me, you know, one way or another. Now, I don't think it's possible, when an archetype is so much at the center of one's life, I don't think it's possible just to get rid of it. I do think it's possible to become conscious of it and live something like that in terms of conscious sacrifice rather than in terms of simply unconsciously being sacrificed. Yeah, that's what it feels like. It's as if something, and all of a sudden here you are in this bliss. Yeah, you mean concretely and specifically? Well, here's an example. In my dedication to the book, to Lilith and Votan, for whose sake I have been obliged to write this book, the giving of myself to the writing of something like that has been a sacrifice of what I have felt that I wanted to do with my life. For instance, that's a piece of sacrifice. It just depends. It has to do with this business at the end of this letter that I read about, the responsible living of the divine will in us, which is a very tricky business. You know, how do we know what the divine will is? We have to really wrestle with the inner material and struggle to find out, now, what is that for me? What does that mean? But to do so is a sacrifice in many cases of what the ego might want to do.
Is
Yeah. Right. The annihilation of the ego is not the point. Rather, the, in a sense, deification of the ego is the point. Taking on the most enormous responsibility for ethical decision. Yep. Right. To discover what is truly right in any situation is never, never simple. One thing the masculine does is make boundaries. And boundaries are very, very important, but the task of making a boundary is a very careful and differentiated business.
I would like there to be some mortality or whatever. In that if something wants us to come through us to make us grow, that it makes a promise not to lie. But it doesn't seem to be the way it works. And I don't understand why that's not the way it works.
I'll tell you why. Jung has an answer to why. This is the beginning of that letter I mentioned. When we consider the data of paleontology with the view that a conscious creator has perhaps spent more than 1,000 million years and has made, as it seems to us, no end of detours to produce consciousness, we inevitably come to the conclusion that if we want to explain his doings at all, his behavior is strikingly similar to a being with an at least very limited consciousness. That's why. I mean, that's... Yeah, or it's like we have this image through many years of history of an omnipotent and all powerful man, that at the same time if well, because the mythic statements say so, we have to accept that there is a kind of all powerfulness, and yet it's an unconscious all powerfulness that doesn't know what it's doing, so it gets into these detours and the machine doesn't work the way it ought to work if he were doing it the way we'd do it.
Oh, like a child playing with a frog and suddenly...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we have this image of God, of this very, very limited. And we have... That's where we come in, you see, because we at least think we could do it better, so we've got to confront that stuff and say, well, now, wait a minute. You know, why did you do it this way? Just like you did. And that makes something, at least something inside us, more conscious.
It really makes me want to be able to not keep this experience to myself. Like right now, I'm at the point of like, what am I here to do? Why am I here? Because I have these, I have a lot of collective stuff coming, reflecting in my dreams. It could just, you know, I could see it easily, collectively, and then with help, personally. But that, what am I here to do, like in your writing a book, if I could just be able to, if I could be able to realize it, what's going to happen to me, what's the purpose of my life, and that sort of stuff. To have these experiences would be validated as far as my ego is concerned.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're basically a moral filter for the creation.
That's right. That's right. We can do something that nobody else can. We can present that moral consciousness.
Could it be possible that in our realm of dreams,
Through a dream?
I sense it sometimes that I'm in different levels of dreams.
Uh-huh.
And that some of these levels are wonderful, grandiose, romantic types, and then others are deeper. And the ones that are deeper are the more razor-edge concept where I'm just standing in the tension or walking around what is the solid tension around me. And that there's something else going on. Uh-huh. But then there are other dreams that can be really grandiose.
I would say this. I would not agree that the ego creates dreams. I would say that the dreams come from some other part of the psyche. No matter what, I would agree that some dreams come from a deeper level of the psyche than others. But that we'll get dreams that are very much at the personal level. And I think what you're calling a grandiose dream is really a dream from the archetypal level of the psyche. And the dream isn't grandiose, but if we simply identify with it rather than confronting it and meeting it and saying, now what does this mean for me? What do I need to do ethically in relation to it? If we don't do those things, but instead just say, oh, look at this wonderful dream I had, then we become grandiose.
How would one get one daily quota of evil to stay balanced?
It's easy. Just look inside. that sounds facetious, but it really isn't. Or I could just as easily say it's easy, just go out in the streets, you know, just pick up a newspaper. There's plenty for the seeing, both inside and outside.
Just acknowledging that you're saying, that is the last night, that we are also good. That's embracing the evil component of our existence.
Yeah, it's like really seeing, really seeing what potentials for evil that we have.
Mm. Now, I have this thought about evil being enemy. And in my dreams, it often comes up that way, that the woman is in red, and that red and black. And that that she's the devil. She's alone, completely alone. She's from the perspective of Christianity and my Catholic upbringing here, she is what was stuck in the closet. Call it, you know, it's woman, it's sensual, it's sexual, it's full of nature and lots of magic power, and it will possess you and enchant you and spellbind you, and there are wild animals out there and you can't control them, and that sort of thing. And I don't know, that evil has been born. And it's just going to be
evil.
Because when I experience what is so fully, yeah, that's it. When I experience fully being a woman, which is not easy in this culture, that I find these dirty looks and very people, very vicious spears and arrows and flames of misfortune upon me, because I just seem to be evil. So many wicked.
Yeah, that's a hard one, isn't it? From the point of view of the collective consciousness of our time, which is still, although it's changing, the collective consciousness is still very much the patriarchy. The most opposite to that is the feminine, particularly the emotional feminine. And we women do have that experience a lot. I'm sure men, you men, when you become emotional, also have that experience. The experience of feeling that we are evil, both, and that feeling comes both from within and from the outside. If there is a great outburst of emotion, that is a terrible threat to the reasonable, rational consciousness of patriarchy. I wrote something about that in Saturday's Child. I think it's page 19 here. The dark trinity consists of the qualities of the psyche that had to be repressed to permit the patriarchal development that culminated in Christianity. Satan, the unacceptable brother of Christ, is only one aspect of the dark God. Qualities of the great goddess comprise a second prong of the rejected trinity, while the material world of nature and the body make up a third. Thus it is that in the contemporary psyche, evil, the feminine, and nature tend to be confused with each other. It's as if there's just this pot of negative that gets constellated in us. It's not well differentiated. Whenever one of those three places is touched in a complex way, in somebody, and then whether it's ourselves or from outside, we perceive ourselves as abjectly evil, become identified with evil because of feminine parts of ourselves, or others perceive us in that way and project the devil on something that is undifferentiatedly feminine. It's like there's this pot of stuff that is body and feminine and evil, and we haven't yet sorted all that out to know which is which, so that feminine and body become tainted with evil because of this pot that hasn't been differentiated yet.
So that man has the point in conquering nature.
Right.
Right.
You got it.
Can you go on to say on that page that we are bringing into taking from the box that if the feminist movement and the ecological concerns, so that we're beginning to differentiate that, but we still have that
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. And it's, I think it's beginning to come back home. You know, with the end of the Berlin Wall, I think it began to come back home. And it's horrendous stuff to deal with. When you start feeling it in yourself, it's really horrendous stuff. I dangled it out there and then pulled it back.
I was thinking about the first time I read this book, something really struck me about it. And then some weeks passed and a bunch of stuff happened. And then I reread the book and all of a sudden I could see how some of this material somehow percolated in there and was activated. Now I can go back and read and identify that. And I'm thinking, even though the time is brief today, I would find it useful to hear the letter now and continue talking and then hear the letter again at the close of the day.
Sure.
And that's what I need.
Okay. Terrific. All right. Yes. Thanks. Yeah. Have a little bathroom break and all that kind of thing. Begins on page 312 of volume 2, and it's a letter to a woman named Ellen at Kochnik, written in June 1956. I happen to be principal speaker at the Friends, the Quaker Conference on Religion and Psychology next spring, and it turned out through a series of events I discovered that Ellen Kochnik was the founder of that conference. And so this was a synchronistic series of meaningful events that led me to say, well, I think what I need to do is work deeply on this letter as part of my preparation for speaking at that conference. In the meantime, just another little piece of it, I happened to find out that Edward Edinger is at present giving in Los Angeles a seminar on the new God image, intended to talk about this letter in that seminar last week. So I arranged to get a tape of what he said about it. And this morning before I came over here, I played that tape over because I thought it would be useful to inform my own reflections about this with what he had to say, which indeed it was. So anything I say about this letter has the additional consciousness of Edinger's work on it. In a footnote, it says that Mrs. Kochnik, or Dr. Kochnik, asked for an answer to the problem of an unconscious, ignorant creator God, and if this did not imply some principle, some ground of being beyond such a demiurge. And Edinger, in his seminar, says of this letter, this is a wonderful gem. It's perhaps the most explicit description we have of Jung's vision of the evolving God image and the human ego's relation to it. Dear Mrs. Kochnik, it is not quite easy to answer your question within the space of a letter. You know that we human beings are unable to explain anything that happens without or within ourselves otherwise than through the use of the intellectual means at our disposal. We always have to use mental elements similar to the facts we believe we have observed. Thus, when we try to explain how God has created his world or how he behaves toward the world, the analogy we use is the way in which our creative spirit produces and behaves. When we consider the data of paleontology with the view that a conscious creator has perhaps spent more than 1,000 million years and has made, as it seems to us, no end of detours to produce consciousness, we inevitably come to the conclusion that, if we want to explain his doings at all, his behavior is strikingly similar to a being with an at least very limited consciousness. Although aware of the things that are and the next steps to take, he has apparently neither foresight of an ulterior goal nor any knowledge of a direct way to reach it. Thus, it would not be an absolute unconsciousness, but a rather dim consciousness. Such a consciousness would necessarily produce any amount of errors and impasses with the most cruel consequences, disease, mutilation, and horrible fights. That is just the thing that has happened and is still happening throughout all realms of life. Moreover, it is impossible for us to assume that a creator producing a universe out of nothingness can be conscious of anything, because each act of cognition is based upon a discrimination. For instance, I cannot be conscious of somebody else when I am identical with him. If there is nothing outside of God, everything is God, and in such a state there is simply no possibility of self-cognition. Nobody can help admitting that the thought of a God creating any amount of errors and impasses is as good as a catastrophe. When the original Jewish conception of a purposeful and morally inclined God marked the end of the playful and rather purposeless existence of the polytheistic deities in the Mediterranean sphere, the result was a paradoxical conception of the Supreme Being, finding its expression in the idea of divine justice and injustice. The clear recognition of the fatal unreliability of the deity led Jewish prophecy to look for a sort of mediator or advocate representing the claims of humanity before God. As you know, this figure is already announced in Ezekiel's vision of man and the Son of Man. That idea was carried on by Daniel and then in the apocryphal writings, particularly in the figure of the female demiurge, Sophia, and in the male form of an administrator of justice, the Son of Man, in the book of Enoch, written about 100 B.C. and very popular at the time of Christ. It must have been so well known, indeed, that Christ called himself Son of Man with the evident presupposition of everybody knowing what he was talking about. Enoch is exactly what the book of Job expects the advocate of man to be over against the lawlessness and moral unreliability of Yahweh. The recently discovered scrolls of the Dead Sea mention a sort of legendary mystical figure, the teacher of justice. I think he is parallel to or identical with Enoch. Christ obviously took up this idea, feeling that his task was to represent the role of the teacher of justice, and thus of a mediator. And he was up against an unpredictable and lawless God who would need a most drastic sacrifice to appease his wrath, the slaughter of his own son. Curiously enough, as on the one hand his self-sacrifice means admission of the Father's amoral nature, he taught, on the other hand, a new image of God, namely that of a loving Father in whom there is no darkness. This enormous antinomy, that is, paradox, needs some explanation. It needed the assertion that he was the Son of the Father, that is, the incarnation of the deity in man. As a consequence, the sacrifice was the self-destruction of the amoral God incarnated in a mortal body. You got that? The Christ sacrifice was the self-destruction of the amoral God incarnated in a mortal body. Thus, the sacrifice takes on the aspect of a highly moral deed, of a self-punishment, as it were. Inasmuch as Christ is understood to be the second person of the Trinity, the self-sacrifice is the evidence for God's goodness. At least as far as human beings are concerned, we don't know whether there are other inhabited worlds where the same divine evolution also has taken place. It is unthinkable that there are many inhabited worlds in different stages of development where God has not yet undergone the transformation through incarnation. However that may be, for us, earthly beings, the incarnation has taken place, and we have become participants in the divine nature, and presumably heirs of the tendency toward goodness, and at the same time subject to the inevitable self-punishment. As Job was not a mere spectator of divine unconsciousness, but fell a victim to this momentous manifestation, in the case of incarnation, we also become involved in the consequences of this transformation. Inasmuch as God proves his goodness through self-sacrifice, he is incarnated. But in view of his infinity, in the presumably different stages of cosmic development we don't know of, how much of God, if this is not too human an argument, has been transformed. That's a circumlocutious sentence. He's saying, well, we better watch out. We really don't know how much of God has been transformed. Some has been, but we don't know how much. And he goes on, in this case, it can be expected that we are going to contact spheres of a not yet transformed God when our consciousness begins to extend into the sphere of the unconscious. That is, when we go deeply into the unconscious, we're going to come across these little pockets that are like nuclear energy that have not been transformed, and indeed that is the case. There is at all events a definite expectation of this kind expressed in the Evangelium Aeternum of the Revelation containing the message, fear God. Although the divine incarnation is a cosmic and absolute event, it only manifests empirically in those relatively few individuals capable of enough consciousness to make ethical decisions, that is, to decide for the good. Therefore, God can be called good only inasmuch as he is able to manifest his goodness in individuals. His moral quality depends upon individuals. That is why he incarnates. Individuation and individual existence are indispensable for the transformation of God the Creator. The knowledge of what is good is not given a priori. It needs discriminating consciousness. That is already the problem in Genesis, where Adam and Eve have to be enlightened first in order to recognize the good and discriminate it from evil. There is no such thing as the good in general, because something that is definitely good can be as definitely evil in another case. Individuals are different from each other. Their values are different, and their situations vary to such an extent that they cannot be judged by general values and principles. For instance, generosity is certainly a virtue, but it instantly becomes a vice when applied to an individual who misunderstands it. In this case, one needs conscious discrimination. Your question concerning the relationship between the human being and an unconscious, paradoxical God is indeed a major question. Although we have the most impressive paradigm of Old Testament piety that could deal with the divine antinomy. The people of the Old Testament could address themselves to an unreliable God. By very overt attempts at propitiation, I mean in particular the repeated assertion and invocation of God's justice, and this in the face of an indisputable injustice. They tried to avoid his wrath and to call forth his goodness. It is quite obvious that the old Hebrew theologians were continuously tormented by the fear of Yahweh's unpredictable acts of injustice. For the Christian mentality, brought up in the conviction of an essentially good God, the situation is much more difficult. One cannot love and fear at the same time anymore. Our consciousness has become too differentiated for such contradictions. We are therefore forced to take the fact of incarnation far more seriously than hitherto. We ought to remember that the fathers of the Church have insisted upon the fact that God has given himself to man's death on the cross so that we may become God. The deity has taken its abode in man with the obvious intention of realizing its good in man. Thus, we are the vessels, or the children and the heirs of the deity, suffering in the body of the slave. We are now in a position to understand the essential point of view of our brethren, the Hindus. They are aware of the fact that the personal Atman is identical with the universal Atman and have evolved ways and means to express the psychological consequences of such a belief. In this respect, we have to learn something from them. It saves us from spiritual pride when we humbly recognize that God can manifest himself in many different ways. Christianity has envisaged the religious problem as a sequence of dramatic events, whereas the East holds a thoroughly static view, that is, a cyclic view. The thought of evolution is Christian, and, as I think, in a way, a better truth to express the dynamic aspect of the deity, although the eternal immovability also forms an important aspect of the deity. The religious spirit of the West is characterized by a change of God's image in the course of ages. Its history begins with the plurality of the Elohim, then it comes to the paradoxical oneness and personality of Yahweh, then to the good father of Christianity, followed by the second person in the Trinity, Christ, that is, God incarnated in man. The allusion to the Holy Ghost is a third form, appearing at the beginning of the second half of the Christian age. And finally, we are confronted with the aspect revealed through the manifestations of the unconscious. The significance of man is enhanced by the incarnation. We have become participants of the divine life, and we have to assume a new responsibility, the continuation of the divine self-realization, which expresses itself in the task of our individuation. Individuation does not only mean that man has become truly human, as distinct from animal, but that he is to become partially divine as well. This means practically that he becomes adult, responsible for his existence, knowing that he does not only depend on God, but that God also depends on man. Man's relation to God probably has to undergo a certain important change. Instead of the propitiating praise to an unpredictable king or the child's prayer to a loving father, the responsible living and fulfilling of the divine will in us will be our form of worship of and commerce with God. His goodness means grace and light, and his dark side, the terrible temptation of power. Man has already received so much knowledge that he can destroy his own planet. Let us hope that God's good spirit will guide him in his decisions, because it will depend upon man's decision whether God's creation will continue. Nothing shows more drastically than this possibility how much of divine power has come within the reach of man. That's it. 56.
Is it a question from the Buddha God, or God is always
your daughter?
I think the issue is that we have to recognize that we have all the potentiality, including the dark, and face and confront the dark in order to transform it, that the good can manifest. No, the dark stays what it is, but if it's not met and confronted, it simply runs its course.
You're talking about sensitizing.
No, I'm talking about carrying the pain of the conflict. It's I'm talking about walking a razor's edge. It's partly expressed by that remark of Joseph Campbell's that I quoted in Saturday's Child, when he said that we have to realize that every act has both good and evil consequences, and that means that I can never know that I'm doing the right thing, and at the same time it's because of the dark side, it's absolutely essential that I struggle always to do the right thing. So it means living with the torture of wanting to do what's right and knowing that there's no way to do that.
And that you have a way to recover, perhaps, when you realize that you have done the wrong thing. I mean, that it's not a personal death, then, and you can't get back out of it.
Yeah, although it's really important to carry the guilt of having done the wrong thing, but it's a real trap to simply identify with it and say, mea culpa, I'm totally evil, because there is the other side too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like that, the recovery of what it means for ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the moment we say, what I did was right, we've lost the
thing. Yeah. And also the moment we say what I did was wrong. It's like whichever we say, we have to stay open to them, that the other will come popping up.
But even that, what I'm hearing is kind of just, we come to need a direction, then we need to find something to express or to say that wouldn't say right or wrong. Wouldn't that be an evolutionary awareness or something else to some place else?
No, I, if I understand what you're saying, I think that's something that we have to be careful not to do, because what's implied is a failure then to differentiate good from evil. In other words, where it's the idea would then be that the goal is that there be a place where beyond good and evil, you know. And that's a problem. I think we have to think not in terms of a place where neither is true, but a place where both are true. We need to think in terms of both and carrying the good and the evil, rather than a place where we don't have to carry that.
So we never come out intentionally.
Right.
We're always
right.
There, we never go around.
Right. We're always crucified in a manner of speaking.
Look at the easy way out.
No chance.
No, that's when it becomes more conscious. When it's, yeah. Yeah. Some of the imagery that
And the second is to feel like you have to make a decision. That is really powerful in our culture. You have to decide. You can't walk the fence, you know, one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes you have to make practical decisions, and the trick is, again, to see it as simply a practical decision and to know that no matter what you do, it can't be completely right. So you just decide. Yeah. If you're always trying to do the right thing, then you can't choose. But if you try to do the right thing but know that you can't, then you can go ahead and make a choice as best you can and get on with life.
But even if the earth could disappear, we don't know what that would mean, what effect that would have on the rest of the universe.
That's right.
Part of a larger cycle that we want to see.
That's right.
Part of that meaning.
Yeah.
Could it be it's not here? The earth? Well, what science is discovering now is that matter is not there. It's not there. But it is matter, but it's not what we're talking about. It's not as
material. It's not as material as we thought it was.
Right.
Ruth Kakuri? Uh-huh.
And then in the young letter this morning of that information of certain individuals having more of that consciousness, I guess.
More capacity to do that work. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that topic? Can you talk about that a bit in terms of
You mean like
how young to see that and
how does one get called or chosen or
how
does it happen?
That,
yeah.
That put a meaning on it that I'm not sure.
Well, I think there is a somewhat elitist meaning in it. I don't think we can get around with that. There's the assumption that some people have the capacity and some simply don't, and that's just a fact. There's a someplace in the collected works, I can't think where it is, where Jung says you can you go to a party and there'll be people who are 10,000 years different in their development in the same room. And that's the same idea, that you have to have achieved a certain level in order to be able to move to the next level. Now, often it's a matter of faith, whether the opportunities have come up in a person's life to achieve a particular level of development, then there. I mean, you see it all the time, people in the same family, like one of the siblings in the family will have fatefully come across the opportunities and been able to take advantage of the opportunities that have made it possible to achieve a particular level of development that then something further possible. No, as far as how it happens, you know, how does the call come? It comes in many different ways. Psychosis can be that. One can be strict dream that one has had, and from that dream be realize that, you know, there's something I have to do in my life that, and I have to find out what it is and pursue this. Some people just seem born with that feeling. I mean, people come to me and say, I know it sounds inflated, but I have this feeling that there's something special I have to do. And I don't know what it is. I have never thought about that. Well, it escapes me at the moment. Does that... Or the other way around, yeah, right. Because sometimes it's the other way around. One thing that I've noticed... Yeah, that the very fact of not good parenting, if it's not too extreme, may be the factor that brings a particular child to question and begin a search that hasn't been met by the parent.
But it seems as if some children come to a later realization that there is something in there after, and others think they know it earlier, and it's not that they get kind of such a big dream or
That's right.
It really gets you. If you suddenly realize that when you're already an adult, it really hits you hard. If you already learned that when you were a kid, then, or when you were a baby, then you grow up thinking that way in certain things.
Yeah. And it's in the latter case, it may be less of an individual thing. It sounds like something more likely to be contained by a collective religion, and less of an individual revelation.
Thank you, but you're going to do it anyway. No matter what happens, you're going to.
The fate, you've got to have some notion of a fate factor to account for the unexplained variance.
Having a child just destroyed another one steps into that role. Both are capable of it.
Some children are able to get through, develop a stronger ego,
about that exact thing. Here I used an unbelievable background that was full of cruelty and all kinds of tearing apart of whatever trauma she was living at any one time and rent somewhere else. And, it, in a way, was horrifying that here was just written by this individual, and throughout the whole time he had some kind of perspective and humor and sort of could see that, well, there's more to life than this. And it was almost unbelievable, but yet here it was. Yeah. And somehow he escaped what you would expect 99.9% of the people living as his, say, twin, which he just eradicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're never brought up against these questions, or at least not very early. You may be brought up against them later, the questions of why are there these terrible things in the world.
Did I hear in this letter that that God is subject to self-punishment, or that man is subject to self-punishment because of the impact of God?
Yeah, he's talking about the crucifixion as God's punishment of himself, his sacrifice to help him be more conscious of the evil in himself. When we impale ourselves on this moral conflict, we are doing the same things. We're punishing ourselves. You have to be real. This is a real subtle concept, and we have to be careful about it because it can turn into masochism, and that's not what it's meant to be. I would say probably that sadism and masochism are extremely unconscious livings out of this thing that if it is lived in a very, very conscious and careful way as a crucifixion, a moral crucifixion upon the opposites can be a very high potential within us. But if it's lived in a totally unconscious way, it's like being gripped by that archetype and living it unconsciously.
I think that's what I realize my masochistic tendency for humility and self defeat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That I read the Cowan book.
I haven't read it yet, but is it good?
Yeah.
Well, good.
And throws me into it, because she writes similarly to you, but masochism or yin yang abuse.
Lynn Cowan?
Just that I now say to myself I am masochistic. And when I feel these feelings that's like being on the cross saying, this is what I am.
Uh-huh.
And it's obvious to me now, before it wasn't so obvious.